Welcome to Lincoln on Leadership.
The purpose of this program is to bring to you interviews with industry leaders.
A weekly podcast bringing you leaders of the real estate and mortgage industry.
And I can't think of anyone better to join me in this role of providing this co-hosting role than one of the top leaders in our industry, and that's Mark Jones of AmeriFirst Mortgage Banking Group.
And here's the host of Lincoln on Leadership, David Lincoln and Mark Jones.
Folks, we're excited to have another interview with another industry leader. His name is Joel Murem. He's a past president of Jenny May. And Mark, I'm really excited about this interview, as I'm excited, I guess, about all our interviews. But this is clearly a leader, and somehow Joe has discovered this ability to be both humble and authoritative. And that's a unique combination, and I'm really excited to share this with our listeners, Mark.
Me too. And, you know, I've never personally met Joe, but I do know that he was the president of Ginnie Mae during the dark times. He shepherded that agency through some pretty ugly times in our industry. And if not for the government product that we were able to have during those days, you know, the industry would have been way worse off. So we owe Joe a deep amount of appreciation for shepherding a vital part of our industry's housing finance system through the dark days. So thank you, Joe, for that. And I look forward to getting to know you better.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Before we get to the interview, we'll have just a quick word from the sponsor that makes this podcast possible. Did you know that the impact from Hurricane Harvey, Irma, and Maria has caused historic damage to thousands of homeowners in the impacted areas? The results reported by Black Knight's data and analytics team state that there were 4.38 million mortgage properties within the Harvey and Irma FEMA declared disaster areas. An estimate of just over 400,000 mortgage properties in Puerto Rico as a whole and the entire territory has been declared. Altogether, these properties represent approximately $755 billion in unpaid principal balances. Identifying properties damaged by these devastating storms is cumbersome and time-consuming for servicers. So in order to help, Black Knight has introduced disaster tracking capabilities within its LoanSphere MSP servicing system. The new functionality actually sweeps servicing portfolios to quickly identify properties in FEMA-declared disaster areas. If you want to learn more, call 844-474-2537 and you can ask Black Knight or email askblackknight@bkfs.com.
Well, Joe, it's good to have you here. Let's let our listeners get a chance to get to know you. Those that are new to the industry may not have been in the industry back when you were in some of the roles and leadership roles that you have. So let's start off by talking about how long have you been in the mortgage industry? And then also, I'm interested to hear what caused you to be drawn to the mortgage industry?
I started in the business in March of 1972, so I'm coming up on 46 years. Fortunately, I had the opportunity at the time to work in a commercial banking environment back in the 70s when commercial banks were truly commercial banks, and there was an incredible amount of discipline you learn in the banking industry. And I spent about 7 years in the industry before I actually moved over into the commercial mortgage space and then ultimately in the residential mortgage space. But a couple of the folks that were really mentors to me in that time during the banking business, that had stuck with me my whole career, and some of the disciplines I've learned back in those days has really stuck with me. So I give a lot of credit to my time in the banking industry to really set myself up for what has been a pretty nice ride in the mortgage industry.
Could you tell us specifically how you got started in the resi side and take us from that time through your time at Ginny Mae and then through what you're doing today?
Well, you know, everything sometimes is by chance. You know, one thing I learned is that, you know, if you keep moving forward, doors open. You don't necessarily, believe me, nothing in my life, my professional life was scripted. I can tell you that. And I was fortunate enough to have a well-rounded background through the different disciplines that I engaged in over time. But just by chance, someone approached me about a position in Florida. I was living in Pittsburgh at the time, and it was a mortgage banking position. And then I took that position, and I was involved in new construction, which at the time was a very complicated environment. But I learned the industry. The mortgage industry from a new construction basis. I was then recruited out of there to a position heading up warehouse lending up in the Rockville, Maryland area. So I went up to Rockville, Maryland. I got into the warehouse business. I think I read about the warehouse business on my way up to the interview. So I really didn't. That's true. I mean, I really did. I really didn't know the intricacies of warehouse. I mean, I understood the term. For whatever reason, they hired me. You know, that's where, you know, you depend on the people around you who were in the business to really help me and guide me and help the success I experienced back in those days. And then, then another door leads to another opportunity to run. Then from there, the same company promoted me into the mortgage space. I became the president of the mortgage company, which was at that time, I think we had about $4 billion in servicing. So back in the 80s, that was still a lot of servicing. And we had
a lot of servicing,
brick and mortar all over the country. We were doing a lot of VA loans or FHA loans and some conventional. And I learned the purchase business back in those days because we had a strong purchase business. So it was, it's one of those situations. And I have to tell you, at almost every turn in my career, if it wouldn't have been for the strong people that I had the fortune to lead, I would have been a miserable failure because they're the ones that taught me the ins and outs. They're the ones that gave me comfort to know that they had my back and I had their back. And it was really a unique experience at every turn. And, you know, I had the opportunity to do that for a while. And then another interesting point, I got the opportunity with the RTC to go down and liquidate a huge thrift, which was American Pioneer at the time, back in the early 90s, about 1990-91, which, again, is another, you know, I mean, it does time when you open a kimono to some of these failures, you really learn what not to do. Because you learn what not to do. And because you see what put these institutions in peril and you just say, wow, I didn't realize that. Holy mackerel. You know, so you go on and on and on. And, you know, one thing for sure about thrifts, a lot of people in thrifts don't know how to manage the earnings on their balance sheet. So, you know, they take gambles. They take a lot of risk that they don't understand. And this is what happened. True. So I went from there up to with Prue Mortgage out of Illinois. I spent time with Prue Mortgage at the time was one of the biggest mortgage operations in America. So you get another level of a look at how the industry runs and huge warehousing, huge servicing, and you become a part of that. And then in, I believe it was 1993, they shipped me over to Pittsburgh, back to my hometown, to basically run Lender Service Inc., which was, here again, it supported the mortgage industry. It was into appraisal, title, floods. You know, we had at that time, before you saw First American or Fidelity get into that industry, we were the largest entity of its kind. We were doing 25 to 30,000 closings a month, 50,000 appraisals a month. It was a big operation that we did with pick and shovel because we didn't have the computer systems at the time to manage. So it was a unique way to bring 1,200 people together to figure out how we're going to constantly deliver on a nationwide basis all these services. And you really then, you got the one thing that I learned absolutely that I think has helped me and really was very beneficial is every day I had the opportunity to walk the building. And that was the first thing I did almost every day was walk the building. And I walked the building. And so I knew Jennifer, or I knew Teak, or I knew, you know, and you get to personalize when you have 1200 people, they get to know you, that you're not this entity up in the corner office that nobody's approaching, you know, that can't approach it. So you get to know them and, you know, they're on a first name basis with you and you sit and, you know, you find out how their family's doing and this and that. And so you become very close to them. And all of a sudden you find this team of people coming together to do sometimes the impossible.
Yeah.
You know, so now all of a sudden I've learned so many different aspects of the industry from just by chance, you know, warehousing, the title closing appraisal entity, mortgage lending, purchase, and just by chance you learn those things. And then I had the opportunity to become the CEO of a publicly traded Canadian company. That was a huge technology company. We built the bond trading system in Canada, We were the ones at the time that company built the AVMs that were purchased when, you know, by First American and then developed. Yeah. So, you know, it was like, you know, that was probably the one job that I took that I thought could lend itself to my future was understanding on a more intimate basis technology and what it can do for you and how it's built and so on and so forth. And when I got up there, I realized as a public company, the sum of the parts were greater than the whole. So I convinced the board that we should sell off. And so we sold the pieces of that off. You know, I came back to Pittsburgh and was in the consulting business a little bit with the family and got this call one day from the White House personnel office. And, you know, of course, you know, personally, I think it's a joke. Yeah, it's a joke, right? Now, who put you up to this? And I'll never forget the lady's name. Her name is Jennifer Christie. And she said to me, well, look, Mr. Mirren, it's no joke. If you like, I'll give you the White House number. Just dial it, hang up, dial it back and ask for me. I said, no. I'm just trying to fit. Why you're calling me?
I'll play along with this.
and she said, well, look, well, you know, your name was given to us as a possible candidate for this Jim May position. Would you be interested? And, you know, in my mind, I'm like, who could have possibly, you know? And I said, oh, sure, absolutely. And she said, okay, well, I'll get back to you. So, you know, what do you you hang up and you go, they'll never call me back, right? And I'll be damned. You know, about 2 weeks later, I get a call back for her and said, look, we did a little bit of background. We'd like you to come down for an interview. So, you know, I get down there and, you know, I have a chance to spend some time with folks over there. And then they sent me down to HUD to interview. And, you know, after a whole day of interviewing process, you walk away and go, you know, I think I hit the ball out of the park. But, I mean, I'm a nobody. So, you know, they're probably going to appoint a political to the job. And, you know, they said, well, we'll get back to you. Okay, here again. You walk out and go, yeah, okay. Well, that was a nice experience. Yeah. And then one day I'm driving home from work and the secretary called me and said, Joe. And I said, yes, sir. And he goes, hey, look, the job's yours if you want it. So what do you think the number one question was that I asked him? I said, how did you get my cell number?
Yeah.
Like, Secret Service, right? Yeah.
He must have thought I was the biggest dope in the world. I mean, you know, he just offered you the chance to run a government agency, and you're asking him how he got your cell phone.
How did you get my cell phone?
He said, well, I got it from the White House, so I really don't know. But I have to tell you, I had no idea what I was stepping into when this was all taking place in the early part of 07.
Right.
Because it was a monumental surprise. And I think the most difficult thing that we faced, you know, going from about 7, 8, 9 billion a month in issuances all the way up to 70 billion a month was the fact that, we only had 69 people and they refused to give me the budget to hire anymore. And what I learned is time is when there was a budget, you couldn't exceed the budget. So we were capped, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, you realize, well, gee, there's not enough liquidity in the domestic markets to buy $50-60 billion worth of bonds a month. So we then had to go overseas to Asia. And fortunately for the Asian markets and the Chinese, they really bailed us out. Otherwise, I think we'd had a horrible problem for liquidity in the American mortgage market during that period of time.
You talk in your comments here, which is really insightful, about how this is unscripted and that doors of opportunity just open to you. One of the reasons we're doing this whole Licking on Leadership program, there's many aspiring future leaders that are going to be listening to this podcast. And hopefully it'll be out there for decades to come and after we're all gone and people will listen to this and they'll go, why is it those opportunities opened up for Joe Mirren? What was behind that? Any insights to, is it being the right place at the right time, knowing the right people, or what would you attribute that to? Is there anything that you did that made yourself more available to those opportunities or those open doors you talked about?
Well, you know, I think a couple things. First of all, you know, I'm the oldest child of an Italian immigrant family, you know, grandfather. So, you know, you're put in a position of responsibility, of oversight. You got to look out for the family welfare and things of that nature. But, you know, both my father and my grandfather were incredible bridge builders. And they had so much pride. And those bridges are around today that they built. So you learn a sense of pride for what you do. You learn a sense that you have to keep pushing forward no matter what. You're going to encounter problems no matter where you are. You just keep moving forward. And things will happen. And the last thing that I learned was you can't really make things happen. You just have to be there when things are happening. So I didn't have people that I knew. I didn't script it. I didn't have, I had a college education, but I didn't have a master's degree. I didn't have a doctorate. All I had was common sense about life, the pursuit that I wanted to, you know, and that probably came as much from my athletic career that, you know, you got to keep driving till the whistle blows at the end of the quarter or at the end of the game. You just keep going and going and going because you never know what's going to happen. And so that was just me. I just never gave up. I just kept moving forward. Sometimes you take two steps backwards and take a step forward. I can attribute it that it was anything else other than that, you know.
Good old-fashioned hard work and keeping your nose down and perseverance. Boy, works
yes,
every
sir.
Time.
Yeah. No, I just said in my case, it did, you know. So
that's an amazing story, and I'd love to dive more deeply into it, but we're running out of time already. So let's shift gears and talk about leadership. That's really what our program is about. And could you define for us how you see leadership?
You know, I think great leaders are very humble people. They're always looking out for the people on their team. You know, I learned early in life that if you focus on the benefit of others, you'll ultimately benefit. But your focus has to be on their benefit, not yours. And that's really something that's true, and I've personally experienced it. So I think the humility is a great part. You know, I think you have to have incredible integrity. You know, people have to believe what you say. So, you know, truthfulness is incredibly important. And that to me is what is another component. And here again, these are just fundamental stuff. This isn't PhD type of work. This is just fundamental stuff. So humility and I think integrity. And of course, you got to be willing to play as a team player. Even though you're leading, you got to be a team player. And, you know, your team's around you. You're the coach. You're helping them succeed. And there are other things like courage. You got to have the oops spot to make decisions sometimes that you don't know what the outcome is going to be like. You know, you just have to have the courage, I guess it is, to make those kind of decisions that you hope are going to benefit, and then be accountable if something didn't happen. Don't blame it on somebody else. You got to be accountable for it. It's your deal.
You're the leader. That's right. You're the leader.
You don't throw anybody under the bus. It's all about you. So I think those are the kind of things that are really, really important leadership qualities.
One of the common things that I've heard is this humble servant leader approach, and it is so refreshing to hear, and it's exactly what I would expect, so I admire that.
For those listeners saying, well, they must hand out a script and say they need to say these things, that's not the case. This comes from leaders. These are common traits that you find in true leaders is humility, integrity, being a team player, putting yourself out there. This is just a reoccurring theme, and it's so good to hear. Talk a little bit. I'll give us some examples of some well-known leaders that have inspired you.
Well, I think of people that are known. I mean, I've got three or four leaders, that mentors that I had grew up, you know, whether it was in my athletic environment, say when I was in the military, or early on in my banking career. But I think the one guy that sticks out to me that I really love is Jack Welch. I think Jack Welch is just an incredible individual, and obviously no one's run GE like Jack Welch did in the world. You know, I just learned a lot by him, and you know, he's just that kind of guy that you can really look at him and say, yes, he was successful. You know, he wasn't a big man. He wasn't an overpowering figure, but his words of wisdom always seemed to stick with me, that he figured it out and he got it. And he always kept his people marching forward. He was a visionary. You know, he just believed that you got to be able to, if you have a vision, you have to create it. You have to own it, and you have to see it through. And he was so good at that. And he's the one guy that I just look at all the time as somebody I enjoy. And I call him. He's the guy. Yeah. Jack Welch.
Yeah, that's good.
Aside from well-known leaders, is there anybody in your personal journey that had a tremendous impact on you and helped develop you as a leader?
Well, I mean, certainly my grandfather came over here as an immigrant at 12 years old by himself with his 12-year-old cousin to America through Ellis Island, and was sold into white slavery because they didn't have the proper documentation. You know, spent 3 years on the rail lines and jumped the train to Pittsburgh and began his very, very successful career. So when I look at that, I go, wow, how could that possibly be? But he did it. That's an inspiration that you can do anything if you want to do it bad enough. But, you know, I had some couple great guys in the banking career early on, you know, swashbucklers, if you will, of the industry back in the 70s. But boy, you know, when it came to business and it came to focus and it came to learning and discipline, these guys, they reeked it. I mean, they just were great guys. You know, Sergeant Willie Melton, one of my drill sergeants, you could tell this guy was built on the code of honor. You know, that was about him. I mean, a war veteran, you know, you look at him and what he says, and it's all about honor. And so you pick that trait up from a guy like him. And, you know, Joe Moss, my defensive line coach at Virginia Tech, I mean, geez, I mean, you know, you would run through walls for Coach Moss. I mean, those are kind of people you look at, and there might not be a lot of things that they teach you, but there's one thing that really stuck out about this individual that I took and kept for me, you know, and said, man, if I could have honor like Willie Melton, or, you know, if I could have the persistency and the drive like Coach Moss, or, you know, if I could be as charming and as humble as Staley and Albert's were at the bank, that and so focused on doing what's right for others, how bad could that be if you could only measure up to what these guys did? And I think those are the guys in my career that I look back on.
Yeah, and I think what you've covered here is not only the people, but the traits that they modeled in front of you that you latched onto. One of the questions I have for you personally is, I've always been impressed with that combination of being authoritative and humble. Where did that come from, Joe? Is it just something that came naturally to you? Where did that come from?
I think that's it, David. I just think it's who I am. It's in, you know, it's part of my DNA. Although, you know, you grow up in an environment where you learn to be humble. You learn humility, because anything other than that is not accepted, you know. So that's just part of your environment that you grow up in, and you just carry that with you. But, you know, if people are going to follow you, if people are going to believe in you, you have to be able to speak with a voice that they can believe in.
Yeah, if you have to believe in yourself in order to have belief in others, is that an accurate statement?
Absolutely. I mean, for people to believe in you, you got to believe in yourself first. And people are really smart. They can tell when you're, you know, when you're BSing it, if you will. They can tell.
Phony.
I mean, when you're a phony, they can tell. So you have to believe in what you're saying. And I think that comes with when you talk about being authoritative, you talk about, you know, I have a belief. This is my belief. It may not be your belief. This is what I believe in. This is what I believe I can accomplish. We can accomplish. Look, guys, let's get on board. Let's do this. It may be totally irrelevant to everybody else, but you know what? For the time and place, it's relevant. And you want to get the troops lined up to get it done, and you have to say it with conviction. And if you can't say it with conviction, don't say it at all.
That's great. It's good wisdom. You know, Mark, we know we both are, you know, I consult with so many lenders. You're in the business and running a business, and there's a lot of challenges facing a lot of leaders, Mark. I'm really interested in getting Joe's take on some of these challenges.
Yeah, and to that end, Joe, if you had an aspiring leader in front of you, you know, someone in their 20s or early 30s, you know, could you point out two or three characteristics or traits that you believe every leader must possess?
The one thing I look for in a young leader, young people that have an opportunity, and of course, let me tell you that the one faux pas about leadership, leaders are not necessarily the most technically proficient or the most knowledgeable. Matter of fact, I would probably tell you that they become the worst leaders, because they're myopic, and sometimes they're good at this, but they're not good at, you know, they're not good people. So when I look at young leaders, I really look to see how they manage their troops, how they're dealing with their people. You know, are they there to benefit their people? Are they helping their people get that?
Good
to me
point.
Tells me a lot about a young person, whether it's male or female. Well, you know, if you're there looking, showering everything towards yourself, then I'm saying, you're a short timer. It ain't going to happen. This is not going to work for you. So I really look at how they handle personnel, and look, it put their hand up. Okay, I'll get it done. Sure. You know, the one that's always out there looking to help others, make things happen. I'm a good team player. You can see how they work within the team. That, you know, that they've got a good start. They have some good fundamentals that they can build on, and that's really what I look for.
Well, I compliment you in shining a light on that. It's really so important.
So, Joe, as I look at the industry today, and I look at coming off probably the most robust refinance period that we've seen in probably most of our lifetimes, we see technology changes that are really driving us towards e-mortgages and things like that. When you look at what's out there and you or again, talking to an aspiring leader, what are you looking at as some of the biggest challenges that they will be facing in the next decade or two?
From my perspective, the one thing that I'm always disappointed in, people who are in a business and get comfortable in the business. Now, I will tell you, from 2000, actually probably from 2008 to the present time was the worst time to get comfortable because we had unrealistic interest rates, refinance up the yin yang. You know, it was to me, people that are afraid of change are people in my mind that are doomed. People that aren't looking to the future, the what ifs. What if refis go away? Where am I? What am I going to do to sustain myself? Leaders that are COOs and CEOs of operations who don't look and say, you know, I should be looking out for this. I shouldn't be looking out for that. It's a point in time where you're the person in that company who should be looking out for the welfare of that company. Because you know what? You may have a lot of money in the bank. You may be in a great financial position, but I will guarantee you there are a lot of people working for you that are living paycheck to paycheck. You have a responsibility in my mind to make sure that those people have a future. Because if it's all about you, then I'm sorry, that doesn't work and you're going to be out of business. And a lot of these poor people are going to be looking for jobs or it's going to have a negative impact on their family. So I think that leaders who aren't looking for how do I structure this? How do I maximize my margins? Look, let's face facts. This whole compliance thing has put an unbelievable burden on margin. And if you're not figuring out how to do more with less, then you're not going to make it. And I just don't think there is enough of that going on in the industry. You know, it's like if I bury my head in the sand, maybe it'll blow over me and I won't be affected. No, that ain't going to happen. I mean, just check margin deterioration. And if you're not looking at that every day, there's a problem. So I think that those are the things that I think are challenging and will continue to challenge the industry now that we're seeing a rise in rate environment. We're seeing an economy that's going to be more robust, which means there's going to be more activity, but a different kind of activity than we've been used to. We may be going back to seconds or equities and purchase, and a lot of folks aren't even remotely ready to even pursue. Or how do I be in the purchase business and still be able to not allow the realtor to control the transaction? So I pre-qualify a person. How do I get them back? You know, because I'm spending a lot of time and money pre-qualifying, but I send them out to the world and they go somewhere else because the realtor takes us somewhere. How do I do that? I don't think there's enough people asking those questions about the future. I'm fortunate. I think it's going to be too late.
I think what you're really talking about there, Joe, is becoming a student of the industry. This is a very cyclical industry. And to Mark's point, this has been a very unusual, elongated cycle. And we're going through a correction. And one of the concerns I have for a lot of companies that are out there is they have not studied the industry. They don't know what long-term capital happened, the liquidity crisis that happened in 99 and 2000 as a result of that and a number of other issues. It's so important that we have that history and have that in context. Let's go to one other thing. When you look at a mistake, is there one mistake that you have witnessed a leader's making more frequent than other mistakes you would caution them to avoid?
Yeah, there are things that bother me. But when I look at a leader who thinks he or she is the end all, they got a problem. I think that's it. I mean, you know, look, I think being a good listener is really important. Being a student of the industry, always asking questions, learning more and more about everything else is really important. But if you think you've got it figured out, unfortunately, I'm afraid you don't have it figured out because there are forces that I think they should be figuring out how to equalize the cyclicality of our industry. You just can't ride the waves and then bottom out when something happens. You got to figure out how to be able to get to be, you know, cyclical proof as best as you can. What's the new ways to be able to process and close and at a more meaningful cost basis? You know, I'm a big fan of e-closings and so forth because I think that's going to certainly benefit everybody, and it's a good cost issue as well. It's minimized cost. But I don't, you know, there's not a lot of people out there doing that. I mean, they're still wringing their hands because refis are done.
Yeah.
Wringing your hands is not going to solve your problem, my friend. You know, it's, you know, but you're always planning, looking ahead, and preparation is really important. And you don't see a lot of it. And you know what? It's easy to get used to the drug that we've had for the last umpteen years in refi because you get complacent, you get, be comfortable. You know, the world is your oyster. Then all of a sudden, one day you wake up and it's not. I learned a very valuable lesson. In the mid-80s, we had our first real refinance. I think it was 1986. And we were like, you know, we were like, oh, my, we were sucking up. We were uncovered. We were running because we were making money. And we were so stupid. The market corrected six in one day, and we had $300 million upside down in my pipeline.
Yep.
That was a hurt.
That'll get your attention.
I remember that like yesterday. I'll never forget that fateful day.
That was an incredible lesson that I learned about being stupid. And you know, if you don't make some stupid mistakes in your career, you're not doing enough, is what I should say. So that was one I learned, and I've always looked out for, look, this thing can change every day. What am I going to be doing? What do I do? The what ifs, you know, the what ifs.
Yep.
You play that game all the time. And that to me is very, very important for leaders.
So I heard you say being a know-it-all is probably one of the biggest issues that you see in terms of behavior and traits for leaders. Are there any other behaviors or traits that you've seen that derail leaders in your experience?
Well, I think planning, if you're not a visionary, if you're not looking at what you can be or could be, certainly derail it because you're going to be short term. I think people that don't understand the value of their people, don't recognize how valuable the human individual is problematic because you don't realize the assets you have. And that's our best asset. Let's face it. Now, I'm not a proponent of fixed costs, but I am a proponent of human assets being a stabilization and a need in any business. So, if you don't understand those things, Mark and David, then you again are doomed to a short-term tenure in that role, and you find yourself drifting from one company to another because you fail, you go there, you fail, you go there, you fail, and you look back and what's the first thing you do? You start blaming everybody else. That's not really what at some point in time, you got to take a good look at yourself in the mirror and realize it's probably me. And make the corrections you have to take. But that's a very hard thing for people to do.
It is.
Is to take a look at themselves and say, you know, maybe it's me.
I was going to say, as Jim Collins, level five leaders, they're looking in the mirror when it's time to take responsibility and they're pointing out the window when it's time to give credit away. And that's exactly what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah. And you know what? For whatever reason, it's never been an issue with me throughout my career. Because I learned early on that I need those folks around me. They have to believe in me. And you know what? If we fail, I'm going to take the hit for them because that's my job. And believe it or not, they rally even rally more around when they see that you're willing to take accountability. So there's benefits there.
You amazing,
just have to realize,
isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. It really is.
As we wrap up this interview, many of us seasoned veterans will enjoy this interview, but we are doing this so much for the future leaders of our industry that are coming up. What advice would you give someone who is going into a position of leadership or is seeking a position of leadership? What would be the advice if you took them under your wing for a little bit? What would that be?
Don't look at the academia as a secret to success. You know, it's good to have an understanding, but I think the real world is where you're going to learn about what you need to do to become a good leader. Be watchful, listen, understand, ask questions, you know, what's going on and how it could be better. What's your, you know, going up to somebody and saying, what do you think about this? And giving them the chance to give you an opinion, which you may never use, but what have you done? You've singled them out and you've asked their opinion. That is so important to a person when somebody who they believe is an aspiring leader comes to them. So I think that, you know, okay, you can read all the books you want to read. You can go to academia and you can do it. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I've learned that real life is about real life. And if you can just take advantage of what's going on around you, ask a lot of questions, don't be afraid to pursue knowledge. I think that's the best thing I can tell these young folks. And, you know, and I think one of the, you know, and I'm hoping that the technology world that we live in today doesn't prevent the millennial class from understanding how important it is to have a personal side to them. Because, I mean, we're texting, we're emailing, we're Instagramming. You know, you got to build a personal side to your personality that you're approachable and you're talkative and you're inquiring and things like that. You know, when people live next door to you and you send them an email instead of getting out of your seat and walking next door and having a conversation, that's problematic. You know, because At the end of the day, there is still a human being behind that text or that email that you got to get to know.
That's excellent. Yeah. And that's where I think your hallmark is your connection with people. I saw that at Jennie Mae when I worked with you there and observed your leadership firsthand there. It is without question the hallmark of what you're about, humility and leadership, but having conviction in what you're saying. Mark?
That's important. And I'll tell you a quick thing about Jennie Mae. I knew when I walked into that place, they're looking at me like, okay, you're only going to be here for a year or two or whatever. So, you know, and they're government workers. Okay, so you have no real threatening control over them. But the way we got them to respond was getting them in the room and asking their opinion. What would you do? How would you handle this? Making them be a part of it. You know, I mean, and that was the reason why we succeeded, was because of them, not me. I mean, yeah, I was the head of the flock, but I certainly wasn't doing the heavy lifting. They were.
I'll tell you what, I got my Jennie Mae issuer status in 2009, and I remember walking in there, and it was shortly after you'd left. Ted Tozer had just taken over, and I've been in many government agencies before. Jennie Mae felt like I was walking into a very well-run business. It didn't feel like I was in a stodgy government agency, and I'm certain that had to do with your leadership there. So very impressive organization that you created. Yes.
They were very impressive people, and they taught me a lot about working in the government, which was went on to help me do other things as well. So yeah, they were good people, solid folks, and they respond well to a challenge.
They're some of the most dedicated people there.
Okay, so Joe, as we're finishing up here, are there any resources that you can recommend for somebody to gain insight out on how A, to become a better leader, and B, to become a better mortgage banker?
That's really a tough question, Mark, because yes, I think there are certainly a lot of books out there and things that you can read, but you want to see it in action. I want to see what a demonstration of humility looks like in a leader. I want to see what a demonstration of a visionary looks like in a leader. So all those traits that are published give a definition, give you, you know, a word and a definition, but you really don't know what they mean because you've really never seen them in action. So you want to be able to find, and that's why I say about paying attention. Get your head out of your iPhone and look around you. Watch what's going around. You know, because you have to be able to figure out what it means to be a visionary, what it means to be humble, or what it means to have courage as a leader. Because you can't learn that in a book. It'll define it, but you've got to then execute against it. And if you don't have any way of understanding what that execution looks like, chances are you're not going to make that step forward and try to execute because you really don't know. So you really have to find ways to do things through examples in your life, which means you have to pay attention to what the hell's going on around you all the time. And look, you know, I'll tell you one thing I do a lot of, and I still do today. I write a lot, but I also read a lot. I read what's, you know, whether they're blogs or I read somebody's article about something, and I get an understanding of what that person says. And if I have a question about it, I'll try to contact them and say, hey, what were you talking about here? You know, I mean, maybe create a little bit of a debate or understanding about it. But these are real life people that have real life thoughts. And whether you agree with them or not, they're their thoughts. And maybe the best thing to do is try to understand what they're talking about versus just reading something or not reading it at all. So, I mean, I still practice that today, that practice. But mortgage bankers, by the way, shifting to a mortgage banker advice, a lot of them live in the moment. They live in the moment. They don't live long term. They live in the moment with the understanding that what's going on in the moment is going to take them
forever
down
the
road. And they need to understand that living in the moment is only the moment. Tomorrow could be a totally different environment. The next day could be a totally, you know, I mean, if you were living on refis when the market started to move last December, I mean, December 16th, and then all of a sudden you go home and your wife says, hey, I can't buy filet anymore. I'm buying hamburger. What are you going to do about it? Maybe that's, you know, I mean, in reality, that's what happens. It has an impact on your life. So I think that quality leaders, look, I mean, yeah, we could all sit around and say, hey, my secondary marketing, I can make an extra tick here, an extra tick there, blah, 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 blah. We get so caught up in the execution of a trade that we don't really spend enough time. I'll bet you $10 to donuts that a lot of executives that run mortgage operations have no idea what the hell goes on in the back room. They don't even care about what goes on in the back room. how many dollars they're wasting in the back room, how arcane their processes are. And it may be because some dedicated people that they have there have been doing it the same way because they're afraid to take a step forward. They're afraid. So, you know, I mean, to me, you've got to take care of your shop. You've got to make sure your shop is in a position to move forward. Is it running as marginally effective as it possibly can, that you're compliant as you possibly can be. And then looking at tomorrow, what am I going to do tomorrow? I got to get into the purchase. Well, how am I going to get into purchase? What am I going to need to get into purchase? How much am I going to, you know, I mean, if I go out and spend a lot of money on leads, how am I going to convert that lead to a close? You know, because the majority, I mean, the average close on a purchase lead is something under 15% because a realtor gets that bar and takes them wherever they want to take them. See, you have to ask yourself all these questions all the time, and you have to surround yourself with a leadership group that are doing the same thing. I just think too many mortgage operations live in the moment, Mark. I just think that's just the way it is. You know, my decades in the business has probably proven me right about a lot of that a lot of times. So,
Joe, I completely agree. We've all, those of us who have been long in this business, see those people come and go. And they usually, when they're going down, create a lot of trouble for us because the only way they know how to compete is through pernicious pricing. And we're seeing some of that right now, as a matter of fact. Yep.
Yeah, we are. You're absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I don't understand why we do this in the business. You know, we'll sacrifice profit for market share. That, to me, is never registered in my mind. I don't understand that. But a lot of people do it on all sides. But you're right. These kind of folks cause problems for everybody else. But, you know, we live with the devil we know, right?
Yeah, amen.
So let me ask you, the last question is, who do you admire as leaders in the marketplace today? Are there any leaders that just stand out in your mind that an aspiring leader should either go read about, study about? Is there anyone out there that's running a mortgage company that just stands out in your mind?
I really think the guys at Quicken deserve a lot of credit because they're innovative. They're not afraid. Now, they have a whole lot of money behind them, but they wouldn't have had the whole lot of money behind them had they not been successful in the first place.
Right.
So I think you got to give those guys an awful lot of credit over there at Quicken because they're out there doing a lot of stuff. I'm interesting to see how NationStar emerges from this new acquisition because they have a very powerful operation and, you know, people take their lead from companies like that. So I'm interesting to see how they come out. I think they have a good leadership group over at NationStar and I think those guys will continue to do very, very well. But, you know, I mean, there are also a lot of independent mortgage bankers out there that have a lot of good qualities. And look, let's face facts, okay? You can sit there and have a mortgage company where you're making X amount of dollars a year in profit. And if you're happy with that, great. Then continue to try to ensure that you can make that every year and trim it up if you have to. But don't try to be Quicken if it's impossible. Don't let greed get in the way of common sense.
Right.
You know what I mean? Don't let that happen because that's where people become problematic. You know, I mean, if I can do well and treat my family well, I don't have to worry about having a private jet that takes me here and there or doing whatever. I mean, look.
Yeah, if you can afford it, great. That is not the objective here. Absolutely.
Yeah, like I said, don't let greed get in the way of common sense because that's really what boils down to. But I really attribute a lot of, kudos to the leaders in the industry, you know, and certainly Quicken is one
ones.
Of them. There's some great ones out there. I think the regulatory environment, you know, I think that what Mulvaney's trying to do with the CFPB and creating some reality. Don't get me wrong. And I am an absolute in favor of having regulatory oversight for the mortgage industry because we've been the Wild West for too long. And as Mark said, people do stupid things out there that cause problems for all of us.
Right.
But I want a regulator that we can depend on, a regulator that understands, a regulator that's not out to bleed the industry and print headlines with the barrels of ink they have. That's not, to me, a good regulator. A good regulator also leads and provides us with guidance that we can say, okay, I understand what you want. Let me put my organization in that. But, you know, that to me is paramount for the future success of the mortgage industry. We need a good regulator that we can look to for guidance. And then it's up to us after that.
We're going to be forwarding this interview on to some of those leaders, and so they can listen to your wisdom, because you were a leader inside of the government, and you did an awesome job of it. Mark, do you want to have any thoughts as we wrap this interview up?
I want to say thank you to Joe for his time at Ginnie Mae and really holding things together, because I said at the outset of this interview, without the government lending that we had during that period, it would have been a whole lot uglier. And then hearing how he had to go to Asia to get some more funding for it just really shows you the lengths to which a great leader will go to help us out. And thank you so much. I enjoyed this interview very much. I've learned a lot.
Well, thank you for giving me the time to spend with you guys. David, I've known for a long, long time, and I appreciate anything David needs. I'm happy to do whatever.
Well, Mark is one of the leaders in the marketplace now and someone I know you'll enjoy getting to know. Joe, I just want to say thank you so much for your willingness to come on and share your thoughts about what leadership's about. Really appreciate it. Wish you continued success. We'll look forward to seeing you around. We work together in an advisory firm called Ainsworth Advisors, and I got to tell you, it's really fun to sit and still see you in action. You're not getting dull. You're as sharp as you ever were. So keep it going, my friend. I love it.
I plan to. Retirement is not in my future, guys. I can tell you that. So
I love it.
Thanks for listening to Lickin' on Leadership, a weekly podcast about leaders in the mortgage industry. Tune in next week, and thanks for listening.